The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
After the Trump administration's attacks on Iranian nuclear sites this weekend, there's been a spectrum of reaction inside the United States, from those who fully back the administration's actions to those who are vehemently opposed. Administration representatives did the tour of the American Sunday morning shows, and Secretary of State Marco Rubio spoke to Margaret Brennan on Face the Nation, where he was pushed on whether the Iranian leader had actually given any order to produce a nuclear weapon.
Are you saying there that the United States did not see intelligence that the Supreme Leader had ordered weaponization?
That's irrelevant. I see that question being asked in the media. That's an irrelevant question.
No, they have everything they need to build a weapon. That is the key point in U.S. intelligence assessments. You know
that. No, it's not.
Yes, it was.
No, it's not.
That the political decision had not been made.
Well, I know that better than you know that, and I know that that's not the case.
But I'm asking you whether the order was given.
And the people who say that, it doesn't matter if the order was given. They have everything they need to build nuclear weapons. Why would you bury things in a mountain 300 feet under the ground?
Right.
Why do they have 60% enriched uranium? You don't need 60% enriched uranium. The only countries in the world that have uranium at 60% are countries that have nuclear weapons. Because
right.
It can quickly make it 90. They have all the elements. Why do they have a space program? Is Iran going to go to the moon? No. They're trying to build an ICBM.
No, but
so
that's a question of intent. And you know in the intelligence assessment that it was that Iran wanted to be a threshold state.
How do you know what
use
the intelligence assessment says?
I'm talking about the public March assessment. And that's why I was asking you if you know something
March. That's also an inaccurate representation of it. That's an accurate representation of it. That's not how intelligence is read. That's not how intelligence is used. Here's what the whole world knows. Forget about intelligence. What the IAEA knows. They are enriching uranium well beyond anything you need for a civil nuclear program. So why would you enrich uranium at 60% if you don't intend to one day use it to take it to 90 and build a weapon?
And that was Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State, and they were arguing really over the Director of National Intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard's contention in March that the Iranians were nowhere near a nuclear weapon. And then, of course, Trump said otherwise and sidelined her. And then she jumped into line and said, oh, yes, they are about to commission a nuclear weapon. So all the ducks were in a row. While the administration was doing the rounds in support of the strikes on the nuclear sites, others were reacting differently. As Donald Trump announced the strikes on Saturday, Senator Bernie Sanders was holding a fighting oligarchy rally in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and had this reaction spontaneously from his audience.
This is a statement from Donald Trump, quote, "We have completed our very successful attack on the three nuclear sites in Iran, etc.
And as the crowds continued to chant, no more war, Senator Sanders went on to criticize the administration for launching such an attack without the approval of Congress. The U.S. Constitution grants the sole power to declare war to Congress. But as we heard a little earlier on the program, Vice President J.D. Vance said the U.S. was not at war with the nation of Iran, just at war with its nuclear sites. Now, for the latest from the US, we're joined by Terry Sheridan, Senior Director of News at WSHU Public Radio. And for further analysis of the wider situation, we'll be joined by Paul Rogers, Emeritus Professor of Peace Studies at Bradford University. First of all, Terry, good morning.
Hey, good morning to you, Matt.
Now, this was a big surprise, although no surprise really. He was giving himself 2 weeks to make the decision within 2 weeks, which gave him all sorts of scope, 14 days within which to make that decision. Was it a surprise to Americans generally that he decided to bomb the sites?
I think it was a surprise to Americans that he bombed the sites when he bombed the sites, which was Saturday. Because, again, earlier this week, they made the two-week announcement that he was thinking about it. It'll happen within 2 weeks. And then, you know, within that time, within, I think, 2 or 3 days, he launched the attack. So I think Americans are surprised by that. And then, as you were just saying, just playing the tapes, the range of reactions are literally across the spectrum.
Now, we knew last week there was a split in MAGA, those who said no more wars. We definitely don't want to get ourselves involved in maybe an endless war in the Middle East. And those who were the hawks, who were determined to go along with Bibi Netanyahu's almost instruction that America should bomb Iran.
Well, that was one of the that's one of the big concerns and one of the big talking points yesterday and late Saturday evening is, you know, what did Netanyahu say, or why did Trump follow, or why has he picked up Israel's mantle in fighting this war? So that's one of the many contention points that Americans have, or I should say discussion points that right now that they're having, less than 2 days after the attack.
Now, the question of Democratic and Republican responses, I mean, are the Democrats divided in the same way that Republicans are about all of this?
Not really, but I think there's a division in what this all means. I mean, again, in America, there is still a long memory over the Iranian hostage crisis of 45 years ago. So there is no love among Democrats or Republicans for the Iranian regime. What the Democrats are saying is, one, you needed to go to Congress to do this. This is an act of war. This is not a defensive maneuver or in retaliation for an Iranian attack on American interests. And then two, what does it mean, for us in general? Is this a quick thing, or is this going to drag America into another 20-year war in the Middle East?
So the real question is that we don't know, or the real answer to the question is we don't know what Iran is likely to do. Has it been so weakened that it can't do anything? And if there are strikes on American personnel, what will the response be? Will it be a hands-off bombing response from the United States? It's shown what it can do. Or is there any likelihood ever of American boots on the ground again?
I, as far as American boots on the ground, I don't know. We have 40,000 troops in the region already to begin with. What Iran can do is attack those 40,000 troops, all of them stationed within range of Iranian missiles. The other thing that they could do is terrorism, both in Europe and in America or wherever there's American interest. And then the third is cyber warfare. You have to remember that in 2013, the Iranians took control of a dam outside of New York City through a cyber attack. So what are the capabilities do they have in that respect?
And the fingers might be pointed at Iran, even if Iran is not the operator of such a cyber operation. Very hard to know where such cyber operations come from. But looking at some of the reactions, Senator Chris Van Hollen, a Democrat from Maryland, said his actions, Trump's, are a clear violation of our Constitution, ignoring the requirement that only Congress have the authority to declare war. Thomas Massie, Republican of Kentucky, said there was no imminent threat to the United States from Iran and therefore no justification. Senator Tim Kaine, a Democrat, would we think it was war if Iran bombed a U.S. nuclear facility? Of course we would think it's war. But then Lindsey Graham says he had all the authority he needs under the Constitution. So is this likely to go to Congress, to the House and to the Senate for parsing as to whether or not Trump had the right to go to war?
There might be it all depends how deep this goes. If this was, as President Trump has said, a one-off and that he's not going to go in again unless there's a retaliation, probably not. If it's going to continue, there will be some sort of resolution, probably not a formal declaration of war, but some sort of resolution such as was passed going into the Iraq war over 20 years ago, giving the president the authority to do so.
So this is, if you like, a holding operation by the administration. But in terms of its effectiveness, I mean, everyone is, all the military experts are saying what an extraordinary operation with precision, with deceit. It was an extraordinary long flight from Missouri to get to the Persian Gulf with multiple aircraft involved in refueling and so on. But already there are, I suppose, concerns as to whether or not they really did the damage they intended to do.
Absolutely. No one knows as of right now where the stockpile of uranium is. There's a stockpile that could build up to 9 or 10 weapons. No one knows how severely damaged the centrifuges are. Yes, most of them probably were because of earlier Israeli attacks and also because they couldn't move, but they believe that some were moved. We have the satellite pictures that they believe some things were moved out of the tunnels and out of the mountain. So no one knows. I think it's a fair assessment to say that the program had been hit. It may have been crippled, but again, without knowing where the uranium is, you can't say that you completely obliterated it.
Now, has Donald Trump been on about his ambitions to get the Nobel Peace Prize again? I saw a piece before this bombing took place where he said he should have got the Peace Prize for the Congo. He should have got the Peace Prize for Serbia. He should have got the Peace Prize for India-Pakistan. I mean, is this his preoccupation that Obama had one, I've got to have one too?
Absolutely. And he's actually said that because Obama got one for doing nothing, in his words, he should get one. An interesting thing, and someone posted this, where Pakistan has nominated Donald Trump, I think on Thursday or earlier in the last week, for the Peace Prize, and then condemned the attack on Iran Saturday night.
Yeah, and that was an attempt by Pakistan, a sop to Donald Trump, nominating him for the Peace Prize so that he wouldn't do exactly what he did on Saturday.
Exactly.
It was intended to stay his hand.
Again, and the thing with Donald Trump, you know, he used diplomacy and all this as a ruse to block his true intentions, which what we're hearing from insiders was in the past week that he was going to launch the attack.
All right, Terry, thank you very much for that update on reaction in the United States to the unprecedented preemptive bombing of Iran by the United States on Saturday. Paul Rogers, Emeritus Professor of Peace Studies at Bradford University, listening to that conversation. Paul, good morning.
Good morning. Hello.
So where does this take us? It doesn't take Donald Trump any closer to a Nobel Peace Prize, that's for sure.
No, I don't think it does. And I think that would have probably receding anyway. I think the main thing it means is that essentially, I think Netanyahu has pretty cleverly laid a trap for Trump. Trump has gone into it. And the position here, probably more important than anything else, is that Netanyahu now feels he can act more or less with impunity. If it is necessary to, quote, to encourage the United States to do further strikes, then that will be attempted. If the situation in Gaza gets even worse, then that's no worry to Netanyahu. I think he can increase the control of the Palestinians in the occupied territories and the West Bank. And essentially, I think he feels quite happy that if there are any even minor threats to Israel coming from groups in, Lebanon, in Syria and elsewhere, then Israel has the right to use its firepower, primarily airborne firepower, to sort those out as well. So I think Netanyahu is probably extremely happy with the way it has gone, and essentially the ball is in his court. And this, I think, is something which isn't fully appreciated in the United States. Now, I'm not sure it is in Europe.
Is it that, I mean, we played last week on the program clips of Netanyahu going back 25, 30 years,
yes,
saying that Iran was within weeks of producing nuclear weapons, or within months of producing nuclear weapons, none of which actually emerged. How is it that Netanyahu has such a powerful voice in the president's ear?
I really don't know, and many people puzzle over this. I mean, obviously, there's a very powerful lobby in the United States in support of Israel. It's more of an Israel lobby, as we know, than a Jewish lobby, because of the importance of the Christian Zionists and their role in American elections, of course. Beyond that, I think it is difficult to explain, but it's certainly true that is the case. And to some extent, Biden was in the same sort of mold, in a sense, that he'd long had a very strong belief in supporting Israel, which many people thought was in some ways even just a little bit unbalanced at certain times. I don't think certainly in Europe people fully understand the way in which Netanyahu is able to work. And a point that I think Terry made earlier on, we must not forget, and that is within the American political class, the memory of those hostages all those years ago, which thought, apart from anything else, saw the end of the Carter administration, really is still very much embedded. 444 days, a load of diplomats, their wives and family were kept hostage. And that really is burning, I think, still in the minds of many people, even so many years afterwards.
Why? But, I mean, that's I'm just wondering, that's a long time ago. It was 1980 when those hostages finally emerged after the election of Ronald Reagan, and Ronald Reagan, to his credit, allowed Jimmy Carter to be the one greeting the the hostages upon their release.
He did, yes.
What a generous-spirited man he was. But, I mean, you talk about the memory back to 1980, but what about the memory back to WMD, which didn't exist in Iraq, and the same Bibi Netanyahu saying that, you know, Saddam was within a very short time of developing nuclear weapons, none of which existed when they finally went in?
Well, it just shows that that was part of a wider thing. You know, the decision almost immediately after 9/11 to go to war with the Taliban and with Al-Qaeda, a few people argued against that, that it was what, in fact, Al-Qaeda wanted. And we ended up with a 20-year war. The same with Iraq. And initially, both in Afghanistan and Iraq, it seemed to work. We tend to forget that. You know, within 8 weeks or so, the Taliban regime seemed to have gone. And it was in January 2002 that Bush made his speech calling for an axis of evil, including, of course, Iran in that. And then as far as Iraq was concerned, you know, within, what was it, 6 weeks of the start of the war, Bush felt able to give the mission accomplished speech.
Yeah.
And there we ended up with a mess. It's repeated attempts to do regime change and to do these kinds of wars have come unstuck. So it isn't just Netanyahu. I think this is a wider problem with attitudes in the United States, and I have to say within Britain as well. I can't fully understand it, but that's where we are.
Mm. And of course, Obama was no friend to Bibi Netanyahu, which maybe is another reason why Trump is so friendly. I mean, Obama's achievement in negotiating with European partners the Iran nuclear deal was going to set that process back with inspections and so on by 10 to 15 years.
Yes, it doesn't mean that Iran still wouldn't have wanted to be pretty close to a threshold state, but not going the full way. And yes, I mean, I think one has to remember that what has arisen now stems very much from the decision of the Trump administration in 2018 to leave that particular route, the JCPOA. And essentially, that is something which I think we're forgetting at the present time. But in any way, I mean, it is something of the past now. And we're in a situation where now it's difficult to see how this crisis is going to end without continuing in some way, even at maybe a fairly low level. But there's so many different things that could happen now that I think anybody who makes a sound prediction is really sort of not sensible in any way.
But this doctrine of preemption, which has now been cast in stone by Donald Trump, that if any nation anywhere in the world has the capability or the intention maybe to progress research into a nuclear weapon, they can be bombed unilaterally by the United States or indeed by anybody because the United States has showed the way.
And that, I think, is the wider issue. We're moving into an uncertain period of dangerous times simply because this is a genuine change. And it will certainly tend to encourage proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. I think there's very little doubt to that. Maybe not nuclear. One has to remember, well, in a sense, cyber, but one has to remember also biological and chemical weapons. So, yes, that, I think, is one of the dangers we're already seeing. It looked so easy and straightforward, and Trump obviously was delighted by the original response. But it goes well beyond that. And I think we're just starting to get some idea of the ramifications of this, both short and long term, of what has happened over the weekend.
One of the responsibilities of being the global superpower is that you act judiciously. And that sense of judicious political action is absent, crucially, in the United States at the moment.
It is. That is where we do have the big change. I mean, it's clearly there are many changes going on within the United States and many attempts by the Trump view of the world to sort of impose its view within the United States. But beyond that, we are in a very different situation. And there's no easy reason to see how other countries are going to handle it. I mean, the Europeans in many ways are really running around in circles. They simply don't know how to limit the potential damage. Because as of now, the United States is the world's major conventional power and can do more or less what it wants. And in the same way, for narrow political circumstances, Netanyahu, surprisingly, is in the same position. There isn't anybody who is likely to hold him back. The only people that might have had some effect, paradoxically, were actually the British, But they, of course, are very much in with him, at least Starmer is. Although I think within the British Labour Party, there's a great deal of concern and dismay about what has happened. And interestingly, a significant member of Parliament, Clive Lewis, has actually taken the view of sort of an almost an all-out attack on what Britain is allowing to happen. And that suggests that there may well be within the Labour government beginnings of a kind of revolt or uncertainty which grows quite quickly.
We'll get a hint of that, I think,
in the next 2 weeks.
Do you think it's that ghost of anti-Semitism within the Labour Party and all of the controversies over that under the last leadership of the Labour Party that has led Keir Starmer to take the view he has?
It may be, but the point is, of course, that in fact within the British Jewish community, there's a huge amount of angst about what Netanyahu is doing. And you get these very big marches, about 250,000 people in London on Saturday, with large Jewish contingents who are very much against what Israel is doing. So the British Jewish community is split pretty heavily, and many people are really hugely concerned about what is happening and what it does for basically the risk of increased anti-Semitism, apart from anything else.
I mean, we can empathise with the situation that Jewish people might find themselves in Britain, who are anti the current government, but obviously they are Jewish. Irish people during the time of the Troubles would be concerned that what the IRA were doing on the British mainland, for example, was colouring the view of Irish people generally.
I think that's absolutely fair point. And you know, one can see that. I mean, the Irish are in that position to be able to see that in a way which ordinary British people can't. And it is a real worry among people in the Jewish community that, in fact, you're going to get a rise in anti-Semitism. There are very powerful groups who are saying, no, do not do that. And as I say, you know, on the marches, you typically get quite large Jewish contingents. But that doesn't help very much. And it means there's a further problem here, which is a complexity within British politics.
Now, finally, we should look at what's happening to global institutions. I mean, we have Guterres making statements of concern and calling for de-escalation and so on. But the United States has no respect for the United Nations. Israel certainly has not. China, when it suits, it does not. And Russia certainly does not. So the whole institution looks as if it's powerless and meaningless almost these days.
I think it's a huge problem. And in many ways, you know, Guterres has actually been making some very good points, as indeed he has repeatedly over the whole issue of climate breakdown. But no, the United Nations is in a very difficult position because there is, in many ways, what we call this rules-based international order, good or bad though it may be, it is certainly there and providing a degree of stability. It's enshrined to a large extent in the operation of the United Nations organization, and it is in deep trouble. And this is where there's no easy way out. We do not seem to have even major political leaders who will speak with wisdom. Very few, if anything, and no of great significance. And that maybe is what we need, because otherwise we're going to have a period of very considerable global instability in different senses before maybe you get leaders or wise people arising who say, no, this is not going to work and we have to take another way. I don't see that in the near future, but certainly one hopes very much that that will come within the next decade.
Paul Rogers, Emeritus Professor of Peace Studies at Bradford University. Paul, thank you very much for joining us.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.